Okay, let's do this. Okay, Kyle, great to see us, Angela. We're talking today about
7-OH.
Woo, so 7-OH, what is it?
It is a synthetic opioid.
And that's, I think, the concerning thing, right? These are in vape stores all over America, and people don't understand that you can actually go buy an opioid in a vape store without a prescription, and it goes by different names that people are not aware of. So, Kyle, you've been leading a lot of the work on this, and tell us a little bit about the difference between kratom and 7-OH.
Yeah, great question. So 7-OH, 7-hydroxymetrogenine, as it's also known, and a couple other street names out there, it's a synthetic concentrated product. So 7-OH is found in kratom, but in very small levels.
Just a trace amount.
Trace amounts. You know, what we're seeing here.
And kratom is a leaf, is that right?
Kratom is a leaf. It's been used for thousands of years. It's a botanical. You often see it used in teas and other products. What these products are that are the basis of our action are these concentrated synthetic products that just have this 7-OH in exceedingly high levels. It's a very potent opioid. 13 times stronger than morphine, I think, is the number I've heard folks talk about. And, you know, what's also concerning is they're being sold in formats that are aimed at kids. So you see, you know, strawberry gummies we found.
We have some here.
Me,
that was the most eye-opening piece. I mean, look at these flavors. Pineapple-flavored chews, and I mean, and they look like candy.
That's right. That's right. And you know, these are available everywhere, right? From the smallest small-town USAs to the largest metropolitan, every corner shop, gas station, head shop, these are now readily available. And it's becoming problematic. You know, these are also, I want to make clear, not lawful dietary supplements. And we talk a lot about dietary supplements, and those are things we want to promote. I mean, dietary supplements can be a core of a healthy American diet. You know, a lot of Americans use dietary supplements to supplement things like calcium, fiber, taking protein powder for strength training. So we want to be very clear that these types of products that we are taking action on and are often disguised as a food or dietary supplement are not lawful dietary supplements. So we don't want the industry, the dietary supplement industry, to sort of fall under that caste, because it is a good industry. We want to promote it. It's an industry that we really respect and has gotten a bad rap. You know, you always hear about supplements not being regulated, but certainly they are.
Yeah. That's amazing that you actually have an opioid in a gummy. I mean, we're not talking THC. We're talking an opioid that can be up to 13 times more potent than morphine in that Journal of Medical Chemistry study. That was an eye-opener to me. And to think you can just go down the street and buy it, I think it's time to sound the alarm and let parents know, let houses of worship know, let school boards know that it's, you need to educate your kids about what's down the street, because these vape stores are popping up on every corner in America. And I don't know any doctor of my group of friends that has been to inside them, you know, to check out and see what they're selling and what the cutesy names are that they're, you know, promoting.
Yeah, they've really flown under the radar. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of consumer knowledge of these products. You know, I've talked to people, we've talked with DOJ and other folks, and a lot of people are saying, you know, what is 7-OH? What is this thing?
Yeah.
You talk to friends, moms and dads, they have no knowledge of this stuff. It's really flown under the radar. And
so to that point, then why now? Right, like I think that we have this tendency, we've been too late, and so we're actually trying to get ahead now. But maybe, Commissioner, you talk a little bit about kind of why are we acting now?
Well, look, I've been very vocal that public health in general is too late to respond. So if you look at every single time a very dangerous public health introduction happens, be it with combustible cigarettes, it took the public health community about 50 years to respond and figure it out and organize and raise awareness about it. Then you had the different waves of the opioid epidemic. You had heroin and cocaine and crack, and then you had prescription opioids. And it's almost like we didn't learn our lesson. We were behind the eight ball time and time again. And then fentanyl hits us again, and we're behind the eight ball. So I'm hoping we don't get caught flat-footed again. We got blindsided with the other waves of the opioid epidemic. I'm not saying this will be the next wave of the opioid epidemic, but it could be. And we don't understand it. Nobody knows what's going on. So when I've asked my friends, my physician friends, scientific friends, and asked them, what is kratom? Well, first of all, kratom is different from 7-OH. It's a neon sign on most vape stores in America. with a K, K-R-A-T-O-M. And they don't know anything about the difference between kratom and then the concentrated synthetic byproduct 7-OH. So they don't know either. Now, some physicians have some health concerns with kratom. Some people describe those as minimal health concerns. Some say there's health benefits. We're not talking about kratom. We're not targeting kratom. We're not trying to educate the world about kratom. We're right now focused on this dangerous synthetic concentrated byproduct called 7-OH. That is an opioid, binds to the opioid receptor, defining it as an opioid. And it's in drinks, and it's tablets and chewables and these gummies. So I think this is a time, and that's why you were involved in the report.
Yeah, so I think, you know, as a researcher, I did some market research, so I went into some of these stores, and I didn't know anything about it. And I think the reason it's important to talk about the kratom distinction is because a lot of time these products are marketed as kratom, right? Like, you go into these stores,
enhanced kratom,
and it's actually like I've seen some studies around 500% times more than the natural kind of trace amount, right? And so we don't know what's in these products. The average consumer wouldn't know, right? Like, you just see this on the shelf.
People selling them don't know what's in these
products. Don't either. In fact, I talked to some of these store owners and they're saying, oh, like, you know, this is the better version, right? And they're promoting the 7-OH, but it's on the same shelf as kratom, right?
That's right.
You wouldn't really know the difference. And then you read these flavors and, like, you don't think anything of it. And so the team here at the FDA did a really phenomenal job on publishing a consumer kind of guide, if you will. And so it says highly...
Everybody should read it.
Yeah, we have an FDA site. It's like fda.gov/7OH. And there are all these resources there. And so one of them is a guide for parents and teachers, and it's for the lay audience, and it's pictures. You can see what these products look like. You can understand kind of what the issues are. And then there's a scientific report for the clinical community to really understand, you know, all the risks and harms associated with it.
So that's one of the bunch of different things the FDA is doing. Kyle, do you want to explain some of the other things we're doing?
Yeah, a lot of work in the food space. So food dyes, you know, it feels like we started that 2 years ago. In reality, it was a little over 3 months ago.
You've been doing a lot.
So. I should clarify. You're doing a million things outside of the 7-OH. But I meant, what else are we doing on 7-OH?
Oh yeah, great question. Before we get into
the other things.
Yeah. So we sent a number of warning letters to companies that are illegally marketing these products, making clear that these are not lawful food additives or dietary substances or dietary ingredients. We're also, you know, working. We saw the referral. The eight-factor analysis to DEA to ask them to schedule this. That's huge.
Right? Can you unpack what that means, like when we say scheduling this?
Yeah, so what we're hoping is that DEA will take a look and add it as a controlled substance to the controlled substances list so that it can be properly regulated.
Because it lives in a no-man's land.
That's right. It lives in a no-man's land. A lot of these are labeled as, you know, dietary supplements or foods. They're not, but they're sold that way, and because it's not scheduled, they can technically, you know, be found on store shelves. There's not that enforcement hook from a control CSA perspective. So that's what we're looking for. We're trying to bring awareness largely and then ask DEA to take some action with respect to scheduling.
And you've seen some responses to those warning letters, right?
We have. We have a number of companies have already taken products off the market. We've seen some recalled activities. We've seen a couple websites taken down. So we're encouraged by what we've seen so far. You know, our enforcement ability is relatively small compared to agencies like DOJ. But, you know, we're doing what we can within our authorities, and we're happy with the feedback we've seen. It's not enough, and we'll continue to take action where we can, but so far it's been a success.
So on 7-OH, we're trying to get the word out. We are putting out this report that everybody should read. We have been going on media talking about it, trying to educate the public. We have recommended that it be scheduled as a controlled substance by the DEA. And so the DEA was at our announcement a few days ago. You sent out letters to the distributors letting them know that we don't want 7-OH in these synthetic concentrated forms distributed to vape stores in the United States. And we're doing this podcast on it. So
we're
doing everything we can, basically.
Yeah,
and you've also written a letter to the medical professionals letting them know as well.
Yeah, so I wrote a Dear Doctor letter using a lot of the information that your team had gathered and trying to let doctors know this is out there. And look, there's a bunch of different names. It's very hard to create a lexicon to educate the public, but we have to have some lexicon. I mean, some of it has the name 7-Omega. Mm-hmm. It's a little sort of cutesy name, or it's just called OH.
Or hydroxy.
And to your point, people confuse it with kratom, concentrated kratom. We know it's not. But it's true. There's a lot of different names for it. There's not certainly a lexicon that we've arrived on, but certainly it's something that's going by a lot of different.
And it's not just in the vape shops, right? It's online and it's in gas stations. And I think that's what's really scary about it compared to the other waves of the opioid crisis, right? It used to be this kind of a fun picture in the education guide where it's like it used to be kind of the back alley. You know, you go to your dealer at night. This isn't happening in broad daylight, right? Yeah. And you could be well-intended thinking you're buying a candy or an energy shot.
Yeah. And people
it's
think
not.
They're buying kratom. They think it's kratom in a tea that's in another form, not knowing that, in fact, this is something totally different from kratom.
So the kratom leaf has been used for how long in humanity?
Yeah, several thousand years to our understanding.
Usually, like, in a tea.
It originated in Southeast Asia. That's
kind
of where it originated.
And I understand there's ground-up kratom leaf. Again, that's all kratom. We are focused on concentrated synthetic 7-OH, which is a synthetic byproduct. So again, I've said that a bunch of times because I think that's the takeaway message.
It's an important distinction.
It's a really important distinction. And you know, you're at a party and they pass these things around. You think anybody knows the concentration of the synthetic concentrated 7-OH here? Let's say Kyle is celebrating the Miami Dolphins after one of their
is that your team?
Infrequent
it
victories.
It is, yeah. I mean, very infrequent of late.
You know, and when they win, those infrequent times you want to celebrate.
Yeah.
You could be at a party, somebody's passing this stuff around.
Well, that's part of the problem with these unregulated substances is there's no quality control. You have one of these tablets, could have five times as much 7-OH as the one next to it. You know, the labeling can't be trusted on these types of products. So they do pose a real threat in that regard.
I mean, I just can't get over they're appealing, right? If I didn't know anything about kratom or 7-OH and I'm just seeing these on the shelves, right? I've even seen some, I wish I had brought them here today, like they look like ice cream cones.
That's right. We've seen those and the flavoring, they're geared towards children. Strawberry, cherry, pineapple, certainly flavors and colors that are illustrative to children.
Yeah. And when we say opioid, we can't forget them, right? There's a high abuse addiction potential here and we see that happening.
That's funny because it's funny you say that. After our event where we talked about this and announced this initiative and all the things that you've been working on, there were a flurry of emails and communications where people said, my kid died from this. Nobody even knows what it is. Or we had a loved one go down that road of addiction, of lying and cheating and stealing and, eventually kids from good families become a different person all because of the substance that takes a hold of them. And let's be honest, most abuse crises happen because of the availability of the abuse substance. So it's directly proportional, right? The more it's ubiquitous,
the
more abuse you're going to have.
Yeah.
Right. So that was the beginning of the week. Let's see, it's Friday today, so that was the beginning of the week.
Before we leave that topic on vape stores, remember, 80 to 85% of the vaping products in vape stores are illegal. And so we're trying to get the word out to the vape shop owners. Here's the list of FDA-approved straight vaping products. There's the whole universe of vaping products. We don't even know what's in there.
Yeah.
They're designed to be very attractive to kids. So that's another thing people should know about, parents should know about.
Yeah. Yeah. Also wrote a letter on tianeptine, a month or two ago, a similar product available in gas stations and vape shops. So that's another one that folks should be aware of.
And so I learned about that for the first time from you, and that's basically what's called gas station heroin. Although, of course, the concentrated 7-OH is also called gas station heroin. But that's that is sort of its own drug.
That's right. A very different but similar type drug that's widely available in the same locations that you'll find 7-OH and one that consumers and parents should really be aware of as well.
So the theme is there are a lot of these very dangerous, harmful products just kind of popping up, and I think your team is being very proactive in trying to get ahead of it.
It's always a cat and mouse game, right? And you see it with other things like certain cannabinoids. Where really there's a segment of industry that does sort of tarnish some of the really good work in the dietary supplement space and the food space, where by and large the majority of folks that operate in that space do the right thing, have the right processes in place, follow GMPs, submit structure function notifications to FDA, use proper ingredients. But there are, you know, segments of it that put out products like this and then wrongly label them as dietary supplements. And they do give the industry a bit of a black eye. So we want to bring awareness to those products, but also awareness to the overwhelming majority of industry selling dietary supplements that does things the right way and sells products that are part of a personal care regimen.
Yeah, so there's a group of Kratom manufacturers, if you will, farmers, distributors, and retailers that are selling the Kratom leaf. And again, that is not our focus. Our focus is the synthetic concentrated form.
Yep.
So with that, you want to switch to...
Yeah, I mean, so that was a big announcement. But, sorry.
I didn't know what
topic. He may be out the door, right?
Yeah, that's like right. I'm thinking it's been a busy, productive week. So we also made a trip over to New York. We had a CEO forum.
She thinks we're talking about New York. That's so right. Terry McLaurin.
I didn't hear what you said.
Washington Commanders wants to. He's announced he wants to be traded.
So he's making, I think, $15 million, and the open market for someone of his stature is about $30 million.
Jeez.
And we will see if Washington pays him or not. But he's now demanded a trade. So
we picked the wrong profession. We should have been athletes.
I don't know if he floated going to the Baltimore Ravens or.
Well, you would like that. You would love that.
I would. Yeah, you know, I love them. First of all, they're all God's children. I love them all. But we got Zay Flowers and Rashid Bateman, and they are incredible weapons. Yeah. And so I worry that we spend a lot of too much money towards, you know, the total allotment that you can spend if we got him.
Yeah.
I love him. Look, I hope he stays in Washington. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. I hope he finds a nice nest or somewhere. I think Washington needs him.
I think so. They're set for a good year if they can keep him around. They got in the Debo Samuel from the 49ers as well. So
the new stadium is now in jeopardy, I heard. Did you see that?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. We'll see what happens there. It's seems like a dicey situation.
A little dicey. I think the team should be paying more towards the stadiums. You know, they get the taxpayers to spend a lot of it. It does benefit the community, but these stadium fights have been going on as long as the league.
That's right.
I think only New England is the stadium where the owner paid for all of it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Got it.
No local funding from the government, from taxpayer dollars.
Yeah. It's always a dicey issue, taxpayer funding for stadiums.
But, you know, the SoFi Field in L.A. is so beautiful. If they can do that at the old RFK Stadium, little shout out to RFK, our secretary,
there we go.
Then that'd be amazing.
That'd be a home run. I'd love to see it back in D.C. I think the team should return.
They're talking about putting up restaurants and a hotel in that section. Yeah. If no one's been to that part of town, it's been economically struggling. It's this right adjacent to where I did some of my residency at the old D.C. General City Hospital.
Oh, wow.
Because Georgetown used to farm us out as residents to staff the trauma unit there. And, gosh, I had some stories about that place. It was just gunshot victim after gunshot victim. And that was a much rougher part of town. But it would be good to see a nice stadium.
Agreed.
Down there.
Agreed. Yeah.
One that's metro accessible and all.
That's right.
Yeah, great metro stop right there.
Yeah, exactly. I did not hear you earlier. So.
That's right. I started talking about dyes.
So yeah, okay. I know. I missed that.
So, Rashid Bateman, a great segue to hormone replacement therapy and perimenopausal women.
So.
What a transition.
Yeah.
We talked about that topic.
Yeah, we've already
talked
about
that. We're still getting a lot of great feedback on that. And, It's exciting. You know, these women's issues have not gotten the attention they deserve.
Yeah.
And so just by having a discussion, just by inviting in some experts to talk about whatever they believe are important issues that should be heard on these issues, it's created a great national conversation.
I'd say that's been the fun part about this job, is seeing how we talk about these issues and then everybody is having a broader dialogue. And that's what public health is all about.
I mean, creating conversation and debate, depending on, you know, regardless of where it ends up, is always a good thing. We should be having these debates, asking these questions, asking tough questions, and talking about it.
My mom started talking to me about it, and I had no idea. She doesn't follow any of this. And she goes, oh, I did HRT a while back and this, and my doctor scared me away from it and this. And I was like, oh, wow, this is really relevant.
Common story. Yeah. Common story of women being talked out of it. So
I think it's also part of the larger MAHA movement or MAHA push, where consumers just want to know more about their healthcare. They're asking their doctors more questions. They're reading food labels more, right? They're more focused on self-care and understanding, you know, what they're doing to their body, what they're putting into their body. And I think it's great to have that level of consumer awareness and focus on these issues that we, you know, we've been passionate about for so long.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, controversy can be good. And look, we're not trying to, you know, have people, you know, be at each other's throats, but let's have a healthy discourse about all these topics. And you get these topics going, they take on a life of their own.
Yeah.
Social media, hospitals, grand rounds, on, you know, rounding in the hospital when you're talking as physicians. So anybody can obviously join the conversation in the modern world, right? There's no censorship of different opinions, and I think these conversations are good and healthy.
Yep. Yep. So what else is going on? Sounds like you went to New York this week, had a nice CEO event there.
Great event in New York, yeah. Talked to the a lot of drug developers and tried to ask them, as we have with the other four sessions, what can we be doing to create a better user interface? What reforms do you think need to happen at the FDA? How can we partner with drug makers and drug developers, but yet keep the scientific review impeccably independent? And we got some great ideas. I keep thinking we're going to hear the same ideas.
No,
they're
like
amazing.
Yeah,
a lot of very formative feedback. So making a huge list, taking it back to the drawing board.
Great.
Trying to think.
So that was stop five, and we have two more cities coming up.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So what's the next stop?
So next, I think Raleigh and then Atlanta.
Okay, is that the order?
Yeah.
Well, not to bounce around too much, we've got some other food stuff going on. Ultra-processed foods, RFI, went out. That's something we've really been focused on and talking a lot about.
So what's an RFI?
So request for information.
Right? she keeps us in check.
That's right.
We have a diverse audience,
yeah,
and
no,
so everyone's always like, you guys sometimes say technical things, so I got to break it down.
You know, ultra-processed foods, it's sort of an amorphous term that everybody's heard of. Everybody has a different, their own interpretation of it, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of different ways it's been defined over the years. The state of California has got a process going on to try to define it. And we thought, look, we can be a national leader in this space. You know, there's a patchwork that's developed in the states and other places on a definition. We can provide that federal clarity if we're able to come up with a good definition. But we want to do it the right way. We want to have full engagement by industry, all stakeholder groups. So we said, let's put out an RFI, request for information. Let's put out a series of questions and ask people to answer those and inform us so that we can make the best decision as we move forward in the process. And you know, if we're going to be realistic, it's going to be difficult probably to come up with a definition because everybody has different ideas and thoughts on what it should mean. You know, should it be focused on additives? Should it be focused on only certain additives that don't have a functional or safety benefit? Should it be focused on nutrient density? Should it be focused on actual processing steps? I mean, I think that generally, like, you cut corn off of a cob, put it in a can, throw some salt in there, heat it up. That's processed, but it's not ultra processed,
right?
Or you put some green beans in a bag and freeze them.
Yeah, cut a cucumber.
Yeah, like that's a processing step, but it's
processed.
Not ultra processed.
That's right.
And so we have to be thoughtful in how we define it. We have to understand the impacts of that. I think there's a lot of research opportunity if a definition is created. But we've talked a lot about this before. Like we're not trying to ban, you know, people from eating cupcakes and cheeseburgers.
No, have your ding dongs, whatever you want.
Yeah.
I've had some ultra processed food at the Raven Stadium in the past.
There we go. Have you had at the Commanders game? Have you had any?
Yeah.
So look, we want to define these things. We want there to be more choices. We want food companies to offer different choices, better alternatives, but we're not trying to outright, you know, ban people from eating certain foods.
And, you know, we're seeing this incredible movement in the United States now with the SNAP waivers. So the food assistance program, SNAP, it's a state program, but the government oversees that and can grant waivers. So states now are saying, we don't want taxpayer dollars going to sugary junk food, and drunk food too. We don't want it going to that food, and we don't want it going to sugary drinks.
Yeah.
So they can be in labs of innovation, and can just make decisions. So what we can do is try to provide some guidance, and even if it's not perfect, even if we don't get the definition perfect, because let's be honest, this is a big task.
Yep.
That's why nobody's tried it before.
That's right.
If we can try to provide some guidance, we can create the conversation, and through iterations,
That's right.
Do something
that's
meaningful. Right.
Yeah, and that's sort of our goal in MAHA. You know, people always say, what is MAHA from a food perspective? And, you know, what I like to say, and we've talked about this, is that MAHA, and if you look at historically at successful societal movements, they don't happen in a year or 2 years, or even a single administration oftentimes. These are things that take a decade or more mm-hmm. to have a really successful societal movement. But what they do have is leadership and sort of concrete underpinnings. And so we want to stand up those really pillars of the MAHA movement. It's things like GRASS. You know, that's something we're going to tackle, GRASS reform. We want to be able to
remind everybody what GRASS is. I know you talked about it before.
Yeah, so generally recognized, it's safe. It's sort of the pre-market side of food additives, right? So if you want to get a new ingredient on the market, historically, you have to file a food additive petition. The way the law developed going back in the 50s, if I can give like the mm-hmm. one-minute version, is that Congress basically said, okay, you want to add something new to foods, you got to file a food additive petition, submit it to FDA, let FDA review all the data and approve it. Unfortunately, the law also had a carve-out that recognized these GRASS, generally recognized as safe substances. And at the time, it was things like salt, baking soda, not these more novel ingredients we see today. But the law said if you are a generally recognized as safe ingredient, you don't have to go through the food additive process. Unfortunately, over time, our regulatory landscape developed that the GRASS process really became the tail that wagged the dog, much more so than the food additive process. And so, you know, over time, it's also developed to allow companies to self-GRASS ingredients, where essentially...
Self-GRASS, I just love that.
Self-GRASS,
yeah. So what it is, it's the same safety standard in theory. They have to meet the same standard that they would if they came to FDA. But they can do it on their own by hiring their own panel, and they don't have to make that information publicly available. So, you know, it does impact transparency, which is something that's big for this administration. So we want to close that GRASS loophole. Yeah. We're going to do that. It has to be reformed. And then on the back end, you know, we're standing up a greater post-market review framework. So once the barn door is sort of closed, we can then incrementally take a look at some food additives over time, do it with science, do it evidence-based, and make determinations that way. So I think that GRASS and standing up a post-market framework are two of the major key pillars to MAHA. And look, we're going to roll those out. They're going to take time. But really, when you look back at 10 years and there's a more robust framework in place for additives, you know, I think people will look back and say that was a key to MAHA.
Yeah. We've already made good progress with the petroleum-based food dyes,
right?
And you're building off of that framework.
That's right.
You're really crushing it, Kyle. And the thing I love about the petroleum-based food dye removal is the way that you also expedited the approvals of natural food dyes from natural ingredients, because normally the FDA would approve one of those every couple years or every 5 years, and you've approved how many, like four?
We've got four out in the past 3 months. We got a couple more in flight. We're going to try to get out. And look, we're not skimping on the science or data there. I want to make sure people understand that. We are doing the exact same review, the same level of science. What we are able to do is ask more people to look at it, put more effort into it. Instead of having, you know, one person look at it, you know, for 1 week out of the month, we may have a team of seven or eight looking at it more robustly.
The prioritization.
So that we can speed it up and prioritize the review. That's something industry's asked us for. You know, we've been in conversations where industry says, yeah, now that you've put that out, we're able to make an announcement and shift to one of these colors. So we've got a few more in the queue, and we really think that that's a big part of the movement as well.
That's awesome.
What are you hearing from food companies?
Well, so far, you know, the conversations on food dyes have been great. You know, we've been in a lot of these meetings together. They've answered the call. I think we do have to give them credit for the work they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a storm, you know, a perfect storm in some ways in our ability to do this, because there's other factions at play. The consumer demand is a huge drive.
Yeah.
Some of the state laws. But these food companies are incredibly sophisticated and smart. They respond to consumer demands. And the consumers have been calling for this. Consumers are also calling for simpler ingredients in general. They're calling for less added sugar. And I think the food companies realize that if they want to, you know, continue to have robust sales, they do have to be responsive to consumers. So we can play a role in that by being and setting federal standards and helping that transition from a federal perspective. And I think sort of the convening a power approach that you've talked about is one that makes a lot of sense for some of these areas.
A lot of trash talking to Mars in the media, I heard.
Yeah.
We were having very productive conversations with them, and still are.
Yeah.
And they did signal that they are
That's right.
playing ball. And so, It is amazing how, you know, the media will sort of polarize every issue, that even though there's incredible consensus, even among most food makers now in the United States, they want to get to the same thing. And if you look at the history of sugar, when the medical community would start warning about the downsides of just a very high glycemic index in your body, for prolonged periods of time, the food makers responded after nutrition labels to say, we are low in sugar. And then they would advertise it. Then they would say, buy our product, not our competitors, because we are lower in added sugar. And so that's the healthy market that we want to see. And remember, when nutrition labels came out, everybody was saying, oh, this is the downfall of Western civilization, and people are going to die and layoffs and food prices are going to spike. None of that happened.
Yeah.
Eventually, they added sugar, or they added a daily requirement, which, you know, no one knew what that number was. But at least now you had a benchmark, and then good things happened.
That's right. Yeah, and look, dyes, you know, people have said, oh, well, does that move the needle on addressing chronic disease? The reality, it does, because on average, products that use these dyes have 140% more added sugar than products that don't. And so when you give consumers a more even playing field from a visual perspective, you know, there's an incremental change there. Well, they will pick a healthier product. So it does indirectly lower things like added sugar consumption.
And there's a lot of research around how these colors make the food more attractive, and it leads to overeating
That's
and overconsumption,
right.
which leads to caloric intake.
That's right. There is good evidence that shows that these dyes lead to overconsumptive behaviors, and that directly correlates to things like obesity and diabetes risks. So
I think the point on consumer demand, though, with your societal shift part, is just so fascinating, because now every time I look at social media, you see, you know, just all these, you know, influencers or everyday consumers talking about it, and it's really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, consumers are driving the MAHA movement. And it's been fascinating to watch what they've been able to do. And
my feed is always like, you know, different people going through the grocery store aisle and being like, you know, buy this or don't buy this. And it's like, let's read the labels together. And it's like, wow, it's in teaching people to read the labels.
We're seeing a shift back to, in a lot of ways, fresh produce, eggs, you know, sort of American staples.
Love eggs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know,
eggs.
It's National Farmers Market Week next week. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So our friends at USDA have a great American Farmers Market on the National Mall here in D.C., we'll be there Monday for MAHA Monday, so folks that are local should stop by and check it out. There will be a cooking class.
Are you leading this class?
I'm not. There's also goat yoga, from what I hear.
What is goat yoga? Like your new yoga?
Yeah.
I think it's literally yoga with
goats,
standing on
your back.
Okay.
Yeah. I won't be doing that one either, but it's available for people attending.
Speaking of Miami and the Miami Dolphins, my uncle lives just north of Miami and loves eggs. And he's 96. He's been eating them his whole life. And his doctors, for a period of time, I think it was like a 30-year period of his life, when he came to the United States, the American doctors were like, stop eating eggs. They're bad for you. And so the poor guy didn't get, like, his livelihood for 30 years. And finally, his son became a doctor. And he's like, that's dogma.
Yeah.
Eat the eggs. Yeah. And he's back to enjoying eggs. And he's 96. He won. You know, at
Incredible.
That point, you won.
That's right. That's right. Full circle. Yeah, eggs, great products. Fresh produce, all part of a healthy American diet.
Awesome.
Great. Time to get to, I think we're meeting with a bunch of scientific reviewers now. Kyle.
Thanks for having
me. You're doing a great job.
Love it. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate the time.
Yeah, great to see you. All right, folks. Thanks. We'll do it again.